When our guest Lawrence Krauss talks about nothing, he's actually talking about something. Krauss is a theoretical physicist and says that a revolution in cosmology has helped us explore the origins of the universe and explain how something was created from nothing. And if that makes your head spin, you're not alone. I've had to use most of my brain power to get my mind around that concept. Lawrence Krauss also says new scientific advances are helping to answer important and profound questions about the past and the future of the universe. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. And we've asked Lawrence Krauss to be our guest. He's director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. Joins us from the studios of KJZZ. And Lawrence Krauss, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be there, virtually at least.
In fact, I was watching your YouTube lecture that this book is based on, and now I'm a little nervous because we don't have visuals. We are talking on the radio about some very heady concepts. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah, don't worry. Okay. We'll get through this fine.
Okay. So when a cosmologist talks about nothing, what does a cosmologist mean?
Well, a cosmologist is a physicist, and nothing is a physical quantity, so we have to be a little careful. And the first kind of nothing that you might mean, the kind of nothing philosophers might have described 2,000 years ago, is just sort of eternal dark, empty space, an eternal void. And that kind of nothing isn't, as you pointed out, in fact, in the modern understanding, not quite nothing at all. In fact, empty space is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles popping in and out of existence, and a time scale so short you can't see them. It's happening everywhere. And it sounds like philosophy when you say they pop in and out of existence in a time scale so short you can't see them. We can't see them directly, but the effects of those so-called virtual particles that are popping in and out of empty space actually change the properties of atoms in a well-defined way that we can calculate. And in fact, when we employ our calculations and utilize the fact that this happens, we come up with the best predictions in all of physics. So we know those virtual particles are popping in and out of existence all the time due to quantum mechanics. And that kind of nothing, if you wait long enough and you're a cosmologist and you include gravity, will create something, which is really amazing. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book is that this classical notion that you can't, if you start out with nothing, you can't create a universe with something without a creator is just not true. Empty space can create stuff all the time because gravity allows, once you create these particles, gravity messes around with the energy in ways we can describe. And you can actually, if you wait long enough, you're guaranteed that nothing will create something.
And that kind of nothing is quite potent,
if you want.
Oh, well, and fair enough. But does that also tell us about the scientific advances, even the revolution in cosmology, in understanding things like virtual particles?
Well, in fact, the biggest revolution in cosmology, and the real motivator for this new book, in some senses, is the most astounding discovery, perhaps in the last century, and that is that not only is nothing full of virtual particles, but in fact nothing, namely our empty space, is actually full of energy. We've discovered, and it is remarkable, that the energy of empty space dominates the energy of the universe. Now let me explain that. What I mean is if you take a region of space and get rid of all the particles and all the radiation and everything, so there's nothing there, that empty space appears to weigh something. And we don't have the slightest idea why, really. But in fact, when we add up the total amount of energy, we find out that 70% of the energy of the universe resides in empty space. And it's weird, when you put energy in empty space, it's unlike any other kind of energy. It's gravitationally repulsive, not attractive. And it's causing the expansion of our universe, not to slow down as it should in any sensible universe, but to speed up. And that was a discovery that was made a little over a decade ago. In fact, the Nobel Prize was just given this last year for it. The expansion of our universe is speeding up over time. It's getting faster and faster and faster. And that's changed our picture of absolutely everything. So if you wish, our picture of nothing has changed our picture of everything.
fair enough. And I'm holding my brain in my hand as we talk here. but even looking into the future, I do want to talk about the past, but looking into the future, and we're talking the distant future, you talk about a world that might be, in a sense, alone in the universe. If the universe is expanding, is everyone leaving our neighborhood?
Well, not the people in our neighborhood, but everyone far away, yes. It turns out that because the expansion of the universe is speeding up, distant galaxies are moving away from us faster and faster and faster. And over time, and I mean a long time, hundreds of billions of years, right, all of the galaxies that we can now see outside of our local group, which has gravitationally bound us, will disappear. The rest of the universe will disappear before, well, it won't be before our very eyes because we won't be around. But in the far future, astronomers who evolve, and I'm still allowed to say that word in the United States, evolve on a planet around a star like our sun 100 billion years from now and discover the laws of physics, quantum mechanics, electromagnetism, and gravity, build telescopes, they will look out and actually they will think they live in the universe that we thought we lived in merely a century ago. A century ago, the only galaxy we knew of was our Milky Way galaxy. And now we know that there are over 400 billion galaxies in the observable universe.
Wow.
Just think about that. Our picture of the universe has changed so remarkably in a single human lifetime. We're like the early map makers. It's not too surprising that we're surprised all the time. But in the far future, those observers will in fact see just a single galaxy and are surrounded by an eternal, dark, seemingly empty universe, the universe we thought we lived in a century ago. I find that rather poetic.
Indeed. And when we look out, are we looking into the past or are we looking into the future?
We're looking into the past. We're actually doing cosmic archaeology because light takes a finite amount of time to travel. Light takes about 8 minutes to get to us from the sun. So when we look at the sun, we're looking at it as it looked 8 minutes ago. The light takes about, four years, to get to us from the nearest star. The size of our galaxy is about 100,000 light years across. So when we look at stars at the other end of our galaxy, we're looking at them as they looked 100,000 years ago. So by the way, so much for people who think the universe is 6,000 years old. and when we look near the nearest galaxies to us are about 1 million light years away. And as we look out progressively further, we can see galaxies 5 billion light years away and 10 billion light years away. The light from those galaxies left those galaxies and those stars long before our sun and Earth ever formed. And the picture we have of them now is kind of romantic because it's quite possible that most of the stars in those galaxies are no longer burning, but we're seeing them as they looked 5 or 10 billion years ago, and maybe there were civilizations in those galaxies that are now long gone. Every time I look at a Hubble Space Telescope picture, I'm kind of inspired because I'm thinking about all of those civilizations that may once have been and are now are no longer, as in the future will probably happen to us.
Indeed. Do we know, though, what happened right before the Big Bang?
Well, we don't know. No, of course. But the simple answer is that may not be a good question. Because
I'm going to have several of those not good questions this hour, I promise but go ahead.
Well, this is a very reasonable question, but I'm going to give you an answer that you may
go
not
ahead.
Like.
Go ahead.
That because space and time are connected to the matter, that's what general relativity tells us. Space itself is dynamical. It can curve and it can expand in the presence of matter. Same is true for time. Clocks run at different rates in the presence of matter. In fact, a clock on the third floor of your building, if there is one, is ticking at a slightly different rate than the first floor. And again, by the way, just for your listeners, that's not hypothetical. That's very important. In fact, it's vitally important. It's useful in GPS devices that many of them are using to guide their cars because the GPS, the clocks in the satellites that are orbiting around the Earth are ticking at a slightly different rate due to general relativity than the clocks on Earth. And if we didn't take that into account, they'd be off by about 10 kilometers by the end of the day in their GPS reading. So this is really, really not just hypothetical. We use it every day. But because time is and space are related to the presence of matter, when the entire universe was contained in a region smaller than the size of an atom, we have to use the laws of quantum mechanics to try and understand gravity. And in fact, we don't really have a theory of quantum gravity at this point. But it's quite possible that time itself arose out of the Big Bang. It didn't exist before the Big Bang. And there was no before the Big Bang. That's one possibility. And it's a possibility Stephen Hawking has enunciated a lot. And so the answer to the question, what happened before the Big Bang, is, once again, it's not a good question. There was no time. Time began when the Big Bang began. On the other hand, it may be that our universe, as I talk about in the book, is just one of a multitude of universes that are popping in and out of existence all the time in a background, what we call a multiverse. And in that case, in that multiverse, there may be some time unit. And our universe began, we now know, 13.72 billion years ago. But other universes in this multiverse may be just being created today. So if that's true, then this multiverse is a complicated, very complicated object, and universes are being created all the time, and ours was just one that was created 13.72 billion years ago? We don't know the answer to these questions. And that's one of the things I want to emphasize. When I talk about some of this and people are object to the possibility, the central premise of the book, in some sense, is the remarkable fact that our discoveries have told us that it's plausible, at least, that the universe arose from nothing by natural laws, that you don't need a creator. And when people say, well, you're being dogmatic, but of course we're not. We're pointing out that it's plausible. And in fact, there's lots of things we don't know about our universe, and that's one of the reasons it's exciting to do physics. So the real purpose is to celebrate our discoveries. But the very fact that the universe can plausibly have been created from nothing without a creator is something that is so remarkable it's worth sharing, it seems to me.
Well, indeed, and I do want to get to all of that, but let me go back to the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. And something else that you both said in your lecture and you say in your book, which is that the Big Bang, and you'll excuse my non-scientific language here, created atoms that essentially created human beings, and that when stars exploded, that helped to lead to human existence, and we even have evidence of, I guess, stars in our own bodies.
Not only evidence, we are all star
children. We are stars.
It is indeed the most poetic thing I know about the universe. Every mm-hmm. atom in your body, essentially, was once inside another star that exploded. Now, how do we know that? Well, in the Big Bang, the only elements that were created were hydrogen, which is just protons, helium, the next lightest element, and a little bit of lithium. But the really important stuff, well, lithium may be important for some of your listeners, but the really important stuff is carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, all the stuff that we use to live. Those elements weren't created in the Big Bang. Hmm. The only place they're created is in the fiery nuclear furnaces in the cores of stars. And the only way they could get into your body and my body is if those stars were kind enough to explode and expel all those elements. And 200 million stars have exploded over the course of our Milky Way galaxy before our Earth formed. And all of the atoms in your body were in those stars. In fact, the atoms in your left hand may have come from a different star than your right hand. So you are literally stardust, and every atom in your body has experienced the most violent explosion in the universe, maybe not once, but many times. And again, I find that inspiring to think that we are literally star children. And for those, therefore, who think that this cosmology stuff is not related to them, well, it really is, because you came from the stars.
And self-sacrificing stars, I think, is some of the language that you use in your book.
In my lecture, I used a line which was just a throwaway line, but
yes.
it's become a bumper sticker. I said, "Forget Jesus, the stars died so you'd be born."
Well, let's take a very short break and get back to our conversation, talking with Lawrence Krauss today in this hour of Radio Times. He's a cosmologist and also foundation professor and director of the Origins Project, that's at Arizona State University. And he's written a new book. It's called A Universe from Nothing, and it's subtitled Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. We're talking about the Big Bang and the various questions that, of course, that raises. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Fabric Workshop and Museum supports WHYY and presents the solo exhibitions of three LA artists, Mark Bradford, Jennifer Steinkamp, and Pei White. Featuring Bradford's new wall installation and video collaboration with Philadelphia photographer Carlos Avendano, Steinkamp's animated video projections, and Pei White's sculptural string project. Opening reception Friday, March 2nd, 6 to 8 p.m. 215-561-8888 or fabricworkshopandmuseum.org.
After eking out a victory in the Iowa caucuses, Rick Santorum has racked up a few more wins along with some momentum. Now he's looking for an upset in Mitt Romney's home state of Michigan and another state that appeared to be a lock for Romney, Arizona. I'm Robert Siegel. Tonight we'll bring you results, reaction, and analysis. Special coverage of the Michigan and Arizona primaries from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Big banks have made big profits in recent years by charging overdraft fees, and young and low-income customers have been hit particularly hard. Now consumer watchdogs are asking how much of this is caused by poor money management by customers and how much is banks gaming the system. We'll take a closer look next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Lawrence Krauss, author of a new book called A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing, and joins us to talk about some heady scientific ideas. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Did you write this book in part to challenge the belief that some people have that the Earth is 6,000 years old?
Well, I think those people, it's hard to... yes, of course, in a way, but I think one doesn't have to just do that to challenge that belief. One just has to get in a car and drive it. If you drive a car, get in an airplane, you believe the Earth is 6,000 years old, you're a hypocrite, because every bit of physics and chemistry that is relevant to understanding how the modern world works tells us the Earth isn't 6,000 years old. I think the people who firmly believe that probably can't be reached by any kind of rational argument, frankly. I think I wrote this book more for people who are interested in how the world actually works.
Mm-hmm.
And more, as I say, not as an anti-religion book so much as a celebration of our knowledge. And some people, and unfortunately, and including some people running for president, seem to think that knowledge is the enemy of faith and therefore we shouldn't know anything. And that's unfortunate to me because it shouldn't be. And celebrating the universe as we actually know it is amazing, and we should be willing to accept it for what it is. And that may challenge people's faith, but
mm-hmm.
surely I think most people ultimately would rather understand the universe as it really is than live in a fairy tale, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you describe yourself as a non-believer. What does that mean?
Well, as a scientist, I don't believe in anything. I mean, I'm skeptical. I don't think belief is the proper word for scientists to use. I look at evidence and try and understand things, but I don't accept anything on faith to some degree. I need to have evidence of it and test the ideas. I generally don't describe myself as an atheist because I don't have the temerity to say there absolutely could not have been someone who started the whole thing, although there doesn't seem to be one shred of evidence for it. I'm more like my late friend Christopher Hitchens. I'd call myself anti-theist.
Right.
Yeah, Christopher was writing the foreword for the book, in fact, before he got too ill.
Oh, really? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
I've interviewed him, yes.
Yeah, and he's wonderful, and he was very excited by this, and Richard Dawkins wrote the afterword, but Christopher was writing the foreword, but as he would have called himself, an anti-theist, and I'm that way. I it's not so much that I can say there's absolutely no God. I can just say I'd much rather live in a universe without one.
Well, and I do want to move on to some of these other scientific ideas and frankly, advancements. But you also talk about the excitement of science, and clearly one can hear that in your voice, the kind of curiosity that you have, the not knowing that you also have, which really, as you write, is different from religion. Religion is about belief and a belief in knowing something.
Well, it's in fact, it assumes the answers before you ask the questions. Not knowing is incredibly exciting. In fact, I often say if you're a theoretical physicist, the two most exciting states to be in are either confused or wrong, because it means there's much more to learn about the universe. And not, I mean, some people think that science, you know, it takes away spirituality, but it doesn't. To me, the fact that we don't know everything, it makes it worth living in some sense, that there's much more to learn about the universe. There's an incredible intellectual adventure to understand more. And as human civilization progresses, we will understand more. And that adventure certainly excites me. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why I write books. When I was a kid, one of the reasons I became a scientist is I read books by Albert Einstein and George Gamow and people like that. And I try and return the favor now. And often for me, one of the most exciting things that can happen, because I've been writing books for a long time, is when someone comes up to me and says, you know, I read your book as a kid and it turned me on and made me want to be a scientist. And I think, wow, that's great.
But you know what strikes me? And I'm not an unintelligent person. I'm pretty well educated. I've been talking to people for 25 years now. But I am just so struck between the gap of knowledge between you and me.
Well, you know, but that's because you've let that happen.
No, I'm fair enough. Fair enough.
I mean, it's, you know, look, it amazes me. I think people are intimidated by these ideas, but they're perfectly reasonable for discussion. We're having, I think, a reasonable discussion right now.
Yep.
No one's fainted.
No. Nope.
And at least as far as I can tell.
No. Nope.
And it's surprising. The thing about science that's interesting to me is that I think people let themselves be afraid of it and also assume Well, it's not, you know, you can't understand it unless you're a scientist, or it's not even enjoyable. And it amazes me when you think about art, music, or literature. You don't have to be an artist to enjoy Picasso. You don't have to be a rock musician to enjoy the Rolling Stones, or a dramatist to enjoy Shakespeare. But for some reason, people think you have to be a scientist to enjoy science, and you don't. And I think most kids realize that, and we tend to beat it out of them in school. All kids are natural scientists. They're curious about the world, and they're fascinated by it. And part of the reason, I think, is unfortunately our educational system. Many teachers are not comfortable with science. About 90% of middle school science teachers don't have any real training in science, any degree in science. And they're uncomfortable with it. And that lack of comfort, I think, moves on down to the kids who feel they should be not so comfortable with it. And it's really unfortunate because I think the ideas of science are among the most fascinating ideas that humans have ever come up with and should be shared. And it's true, the mathematical details of what I do are beyond many people because they haven't taken the mathematics. But the same is true for a complex musical piece, I think. But that doesn't mean I can't enjoy it. And I think these ideas are fascinating, and ultimately they're the same questions we all ask about ourselves. We all ask, where do we come from? Where are we going? What are we made of? Those are the questions that humans ask from the moment they can begin to ask questions. And science provides fascinating new attempts at answers to them. And I think it's really sad that so many people turn themselves off from the possibility of even beginning to grasp what science is telling us about the universe, either because they think it's too difficult, too boring, or because they feel that somehow their faith might be threatened and therefore they'd rather not know. And that, to me, is the saddest of all.
Well, and even going back to your book and even going back to some of the ideas in your book, when we look at the universe and when we look on a starry night and we look up at the universe, it sounds like what we see, and if it's stars or galaxies, is less than 1% of what actually is in the universe. Did I hear that, read that right?
Yeah, we're just a bit of cosmic pollution in a universe made of dark matter and dark energy. It turns out 70% of the energy of the universe is dark energy. The rest is the stuff called dark matter, which seems to dominate the mass of galaxies and clusters of galaxies, and it's, we believe, made of some new type of elementary particle. We're building experiments on Earth to look for it. And everything we see in the night sky, all the stars and galaxies, all the beauty of the night sky, you could get rid of all of that, and the universe would be largely the same.
Wow.
We are just a little bit of leftover in a universe of dark matter and dark energy. So much for a universe that was created for us.
And that's Lawrence Krauss, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a cosmologist, foundation professor, director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, and joins us from the studios of KJZZ. He's the author of a new book we're talking about called A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. He's written a number of other books and hundreds of scholarly papers, and we saw a YouTube video of him talking about some of the ideas in this book, and that's why we invited him to join us on Radio Times. Intriguing stuff. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to get some callers in, but let me go back to Albert Einstein and his theory of general relativity. How far did Einstein, I guess, take us in our understanding of the universe? Is there an easy answer to that question?
Well, he changed everything in the sense by having a new theory of gravity. His theory of general relativity was the first theory of space and time. Right. It told us how space and time responded to the presence of matter. And therefore, since it was a theory of space and time, it was the first theory that we could use to describe the universe itself and how it evolves, not how things move through space, but how space itself evolves. And until general relativity, we really couldn't even describe the universe. So he created the playing field on which we now do cosmology. And he also, by the way, added an extra term to his equations, which he called his biggest blunder, called the cosmological constant, because he thought the universe was static. Back in 1916, everyone thought the universe was static and eternal. And the problem is that gravity, as I like to say, gravity sucks. It always pulls. It never pushes. And therefore, you can't have a static universe because everything will collapse together eventually. And he added this extra small repulsive term to his equations to keep the universe static. He later called it his biggest blunder. But what's amazing is it turns out the energy of empty space that we've discovered almost 100 years later seems to provide exactly the term that he put in, not to make the universe static, but in fact to be strong enough to make it expand and expand faster and faster. So in many ways, if he'd had the courage of his convictions and not thrown away that term, he could have predicted what we've now measured.
Amazing. Let me get some callers in. It looks like we have Rita from Haddonfield joining us on Radio Times. And Rita, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I love this topic. I'm loving this whole discussion.
Great.
My question is, I've been a student of New Age spirituality for a very long time, and I don't want to get into the details, but some things have opened up for me that weren't there before. The question I have is, it seems like a lot of the things that I'm reading and seeing in movies and whatnot have to do with quantum physics, and it seems like science is beginning to maybe in some ways prove or support some of the beliefs of New Age spirituality, which is that we are co-creators, our thoughts create our things, the law of attraction. Yeah. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Rita, thanks for the call. Lawrence, go ahead.
It's a very polite question. I hate to give you an answer that you're not going to like, but in fact, quantum mechanics does not validate any of New Age spirituality. In fact, much of what you've seen in books like The Secret and movies like What the Bleep Do You Know is complete nonsense. I hate to tell you that. They take the laws of quantum mechanics, which means the universe. Quantum mechanics is very fascinating. It says the universe is very strange on small scales, but it does not say that we are co-creators, that when we think about the universe, we create things, or we can change the way the universe behaves merely by thinking about it. I'm sorry to tell you that, but it is a fact that these people abuse quantum mechanics, and in fact, as far as I can see, abuse people like you by arguing that science validates what they're talking about, and it doesn't validate any of it. In fact, it contradicts it. So quantum mechanics is stranger than you can imagine, and it's fascinating to learn about. But unfortunately, it doesn't validate the hucksters who are making money off people like you by selling those kind of books.
Oh, Rita, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. One of the things you write in your book is, whenever we ask why, we generally mean how. Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you ask why, you presume purpose. And I think most, for example, we can ask why are there, I would say, 9 planets, because Pluto will always be a planet.
Oh, is that right?
But let's say, why are there 8 planets? When we mean why are there 8 planets, we don't mean why did someone put 8 planets. We mean how are there 8 planets? How did our solar system form so that there are 8 planets and they're in the positions they are? Why is the sky blue? We don't really mean, you know, what's the purpose of a blue sky? We mean what's the physics that tells us that the sky can be blue? Why does a rainbow have the colors it has? So really, most why questions ultimately come down to how questions. And if you continue to ask, you can keep saying why, and it's like turtles all the way down. It's like an infinite number of questions. But you can, but ultimately, you're presuming that there's purpose when you ask why. And that, is, again, assumes the answer before you ask the question. Now, there may be purpose to the universe, and there may be some ultimate why. There may be some purpose to our universe, that we have a purpose to our existence beyond the meaning we make in our own lives. But as far as we can tell by looking out at the universe, there's no evidence of such purpose. So if there is, it's something yet we haven't discovered, at least in by our studies of the natural world.
And by purpose, you mean that we are on Earth for some particular reason?
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to the kind of existential reasons?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that you've hit it exactly. I think there's no evidence that there's any purpose to our being on Earth. And that shouldn't depress people. I mean, or shouldn't. To me, I find that energizing, because it means that we evolved here in this random place in the middle of nowhere. We're remarkably fortunate to have a consciousness that allows us to appreciate the universe and understand our own existence back to the earliest moments of the Big Bang. And therefore, the meaning in our lives is the meaning we make. And therefore, we should be emboldened to make our lives more meaningful. It doesn't mean that the fact that we weren't created here for a reason means there's, you should just give up. In fact, quite the opposite. Make the most of your brief moment in the sun.
Let me give Michael from Bristol a chance to join our conversation. And Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question. What if there's some kind of afterlife? What if there's one life, purgatory, heaven, and all are saved, or reincarnation, and all are saved? If there is some kind of afterlife, isn't your model partially incorrect?
And Michael, just one quick question. Do you believe in an afterlife? Or you're just asking what if?
I'm a reincarnationist, but okay. I got it through reading Christmas Humphrey's Buddhism.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let me give Lawrence Krauss a chance to weigh in on that.
Well,
go ahead.
I mean, what if there are? Yeah, I mean, the point is, there's no evidence that there's an afterlife, and in fact, you know, there's lots of what ifs, you know, we can ask about them, but we can ask what is rather than what if. And I think what is, for me at least, more interesting. But let me just say that there's no, in terms of reincarnation, let me point out one thing. There are more people alive now than lived on the entire planet for the rest of human history. So I don't know how you can exchange one soul for another when there are many more now than ever existed before. And there will be a lot more. Unfortunately, because we're not reining in our population in the future, so I think that reincarnation is, if you work out the mathematics, is simply nonsense unless you're willing to be reincarnated into an insect or something. But even then, the number of living entities on Earth changes all the time, and there's no evidence that there's a soul. There's none of that. I mean, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, I want to point out, but there's just no evidence for it. So I'd say if I was a betting man, I would argue that, in fact, that there is no afterlife. And if people ask what it's like to after you die, what I like to say it is that, well, try and remember what it was like before you were born.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you think that there are other, and I'm using life in the most sort of generic, elastic terms, but that there is life somewhere else out in the universe, this large and expanding universe that we live in?
Well, it's hard for me to imagine there isn't. You know, yeah. We now know that there are about 400 billion galaxies in the observable universe. Each contains 100 billion stars. We've now learned that most stars have planets around them, something that most astrophysicists like myself had assumed before, but now we have evidence of it. And we've learned that solar systems exist in the most exotic forms. Now, we also know that life evolved here on Earth about as early as it could have after the Earth formed, within a few hundred million years after the bombardment of meteors and comets had died down. The oldest fossils are almost 4 billion years old. And so, therefore, it appears that life forms relatively quickly, if we're any example. And what you need is light and water and organic materials. And all of those things exist throughout the universe. Water is abundant, light obviously abundant from stars, and even organic materials. One of the things we learned from the Hale-Bopp comet was not that there was a spacecraft behind it, but rather that there were organic materials on it, the basis of amino acids. And so it's hard for me to imagine the universe isn't teeming with life. In fact, I would be very surprised if in the next decade or two we didn't discover evidence of at least microbial fossilized life on, say, underneath the surface of Mars or maybe in the oceans of Europa. Those could easily be our cousins, however, because we've discovered that material travels back and forth between the planets. Now, the question is, well, okay, so there's lots of life, I think, in the universe, and we'll probably discover evidence for it. But is there intelligent life? That's a much harder question. It's not clear that intelligence is an evolutionary imperative. And so we just don't know. It could be very rare, but I'm betting it's out there somewhere.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Lawrence Krauss. He's a cosmologist, also director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. And we're talking about nothing. In fact, his new book is called A Universe from Nothing. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Colorectal cancer is the second deadliest cancer in the U.S. It is also one of the most preventable. For most people, successful prevention begins at age 50 with a skilled colonoscopy for the detection and removal of any precancerous polyps. Accuracy is crucial. The gastroenterology team at Fox Chase brings experience and expertise to this important screening regimen. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
On the next Fresh Air, as the anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster approaches, investigative reporter Dan Edge reconstructs the crisis.
All the workers we spoke to said that, you know, after that massive earthquake, they were completely sure everything was fine because this is Japan, and nuclear power is safe in Japan. You know, this is 1 minute before the tsunami hit.
Edge's frontline documentary is Inside Japan's Nuclear Meltdown. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. When is a military suicide a casualty of war? A Marine's family struggles for compensation after his PTSD-related death. Also, Montana's AG considers criminal charges against Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen for fraud and mismanagement. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Lawrence Krauss about how new scientific advances are helping us understand the universe and answering important and profound questions about the past and future of the universe. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Lawrence, you said something right before the break about intelligence and evolution. I was talking and scribbling at the same time, and I can't even read my own handwriting here. Talk about intelligence, well, right? Well, but what were you saying? What were you saying?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, you know, intelligence formed on Earth by sort of a series of accidents. A big comet or meteor hit the Earth maybe 65 million years ago and probably helped wipe out the dinosaurs, creating a niche for mammals, and humans evolved. And so it's not clear that evolution always produces intelligent beings. Hmm. And therefore, it could be that intelligent life is very rare. It may require a lot of precursors and a stable environment for 4 billion years. And so it could be that even if the universe is teeming with life, it's not teeming with intelligence. But even if it's extremely rare, there's so many stars out there that and solar systems that I'm willing to believe that intelligence does exist elsewhere in the universe. However, the universe is a big place, and it's therefore not very likely that we'll ever know about it, even if it's out there. And it's worth listening, and the SETI people are listening with their radio telescopes. But it's a real long shot that even if life exists, that we'll ever know about it, because it's just such a big universe.
But bigger, right?
We're alone. It's big and getting bigger, and things are getting farther away all the time. And so, you know, the only hope we probably have of seeing intelligent life or learning about it is in our galaxy. But even there, the average distance between stars is so large that it's a long, it's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Maybe it's there. Maybe we'll find out about it. It's certainly worth listening and looking, because it would be one of the most profound discoveries of all, of course, if we discovered the other intelligences in the universe. So as long as it isn't too expensive, I'm in favor of the search. But I wouldn't hold my breath.
Let me get Bill from King of Prussia to join our conversation. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So my question deals with the singularity prior to the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. I'm struggling with the concept of how can near-infinite mass and the four forces that pre-existed exist in such a small space. And does superposition help answer the quandary of all that mass existing in such a tiny space?
Thanks, Bill.
Well, that's a good question. It's really hard to picture our entire universe, all the galaxies, all the mass of all the galaxies that we see contained in a region smaller than an atom. I even once wrote a whole book about that. And it is almost unfathomable to imagine how you could compress things in such a dense, hot state. But in fact, all evidence is that existed in such a state. And you asked about this thing called quantum superposition. That's really not even... That's not it. All the stuff was really there in a small space. Now, the singularity itself, if you follow everything back to t equals zero and all the equations back, then the universe was infinitely dense in a single point. But I think most physicists would say that's just an artifact, because we know the laws of physics break down. We know that a quantum theory of gravity is necessary to really describe the universe at t equals zero, and we don't have such a theory. So extrapolating general relativity alone back to that time is probably not appropriate. We can extrapolate it back to really short periods after that. I mean, unbelievably short periods, when the universe really was contained in a region the size of an atom. But t equals zero still eludes us in terms of our theories, because we don't really yet have a quantum theory of gravity.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me ask you, Lawrence, about Higgs, the Higgs particle, and it's certainly been in the news in the last couple of months. What's the significance?
Well, the significance is it could explain, like many things, why we're here. The Higgs particle is an implication of a theory. Theoretical ideas have been around for almost 50 years. It's really amazing if it's true that the particles that make up our bodies, according to our current understanding of particle physics, have no fundamental mass. But what happens is there's this background field throughout the universe called the Higgs field. And particles kind of interact with it. It's like swimming through molasses. particles interact with that field, and they get, and there's resistance to their motion, and they begin to act like they have mass. And some particles interact more strongly with that field and act more massive, and other ones interact less strongly and act less massive. So mass is an artifact, an accident of our existence, if you wish. Now, this is a fantastical idea, and it's hard to believe it's really true, but if you ping that field, if you smash things into it with enough energy, you can knock out real particles called Higgs particles. And we think that in the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, the largest accelerator in the world, we've amassed enough energy to smash things together in such a small space that we might create these real particles called Higgs particles, which would tell us that this crazy idea is true. And in fact, in the Large Hadron Collider, there's tentative evidence that we've discovered the Higgs particle. If we really have, it will really be a testimonial to the power of the human intellect that over 50 years we've created this picture that is actually right. And if you're a theoretical physicist sitting in a room working on these equations, it's terrifying to think that you're actually right sometimes, that the universe actually obeys the ideas that you're developing. And it would be remarkable. In fact, I was betting it wouldn't be there because most scientific ideas are wrong. The universe tends to surprise us. It's more surprising than our simple imaginations can come up with, and the universe has greater imagination than we do, which is why it's worth continuing to explore the universe. Well, and I would have been very surprised not to be surprised. So, in some sense, I'm more surprised if the Higgs field is there than if it isn't.
Oh, that's fascinating. It's often called, or not often, but I've seen it referred to as the God particle. And I'm just curious, as someone, you're as you'd say, a non-believer, and does that distract us from what you think the real science is about?
Of course it did. It was a silly name. By the God particle, it meant it's responsible if it's there. The Higgs field is responsible for our existence by being responsible for mass, and we wouldn't be here if mass didn't exist. And so it was a word used to mean that it's responsible for our existence. It has nothing to do with God, and it distracts from the argument. And we could have called it any other thing, but someone called it the God particle, and it's a catchy name.
And that's Lawrence Krauss, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Again, a cosmologist. Do you ever get called a cosmetologist? I'm just curious.
Absolutely. Once, I remember the first time 20-some-odd years ago when I gave a public lecture in Pennsylvania, actually.
Oh, yeah?
They said, on the cover of the paper, it said, Lawrence Krauss, the world's foremost expert at the interface between particle physics and cosmetology. And I thought that was great. No one asked me to do their hair.
Well, welcome to Pennsylvania. What can I say? He's a cosmologist, foundation professor, director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. He's written a number of books. The most recent one, the one we're talking about, is called A Universe from Nothing. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Denny from Chester Springs to join us. And Denny, go ahead. You're on Radio Time.
Hi, thank you, Marty.
You're
also
welcome.
A long-time listener, another great show.
Thank you.
So my question is that I have heard this argument a number of times, the argument that we can explain the universe without having any kind of a prime mover or a first mover.
Right.
By our understanding of how we understand the universe today. But nothing that I've read, and I'm limited in my ability to grasp all this, I've really gotten it. Okay, so that explains it, and we don't need a prior, another explanation. We don't need a first mover. You know, the Big Bang, whatever came, at that T0, which we can't get to by the equations we understand now, that requires something else beyond what we know.
Right.
Gravity, strings, the whole thing. Can you just make one more stab at helping me get my head around how we could really get something out of nothing?
No, it's a great question, Denny, and I appreciate the call. And go ahead, Lawrence Krauss.
Well, it's a good question. Of course, I wrote a whole book about it, and obviously, Denny, the first thing I'd say is read the book, because I tried to take it carefully through how that can happen. You're right. It's a really hard thing to imagine how you can get something without a prime mover, without someone someone purposely causing it. It turns out if you have quantum gravity, even without a known theory, we know that if we quantize space, then space itself is dynamical, and it can pop in and out of existence without any impediments, and you can actually create universes where there was no space itself. But in fact, ultimately, the multiverse might replace your prime mover, because we now have good reasons, as I describe in the book, for thinking that our universe is not unique, that there are many universes. And in that case, a multiverse could itself be eternal.
Hmm.
And our universe could have spontaneously arisen in a multiverse, and even the laws of physics associated with our universe could have arisen spontaneously as our universe arose, so that there are not even any laws before that. And in that case, I would argue that the multiverse in some sense replaces the prime mover. But the big difference between the multiverse and a prime mover is the multiverse is well-motivated. It's motivated based on our understanding of what we know about the universe. It's not invented by philosophers to explain something they didn't understand. And I think there's a big difference. And you know, one obviously on a radio program like this, I can't take you carefully through the arguments, and that's why I wrote the book, and I hope you'll take a look at it. Maybe you'll
another
find
shameless
it doesn't
plug, yes.
Well, obviously, but I'm trying to, you know, I think I try to carefully take you through this ways in which something can come from nothing, and it can all arise without any real purposeful cause as merely an accident in what may be a multiverse of universes, some of which are arising right now by accident.
Danny, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But are you saying then, just to pick up on what you were saying to our caller, that it's all sort of a great big accident?
As far as we can tell, and I don't see what's so bad about that.
No,
I mean,
I'm not complaining.
You know, every day we see snowflakes. Well, not where you are, not where I'm in Phoenix, but snow. I think you're having snow there today. And these snowflakes, these beautiful crystals, you look them under a microscope, they look like Christmas ornaments. And they arise accidentally and spontaneously due to laws of nature. And we don't doesn't diminish their beauty. A rainbow is beautiful, but it becomes more beautiful if we actually try and understand how it arose. And we don't happen to think anyone painted it on the sky. So I guess remarkable accidents are worth cherishing, and we are one of the most remarkable accidents ever.
Danny, thanks for the call. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let's see what Shakira from Trenton has to say. Shakira, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning, Maureen.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for this show.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that very little of what you're saying, sir, is antithetical to my faith. I'm a Muslim, and your description of nothing is as close a description as I've heard a non-Muslim gives to what is the meaning of the word Allah as anything else. It means the one like whom there is no other. Even your discussion about snow crystals, there's a Japanese scientist who's done experiments around water crystals and showing that the shape changes based on whether or not you're speaking good words or ugly words to the water. So, I disagree with.
Okay, fair enough, Shakira. Okay. I know you agree with some of what you might have said, Lawrence, but not everything. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the claim that water crystals change depending on whether you talk to them is not substantiated and, in fact, is not true. But, in fact, if what I said validates your beliefs, that's great. I mean, the point is your theology should mesh with the evidence of reality. And your beliefs, if they don't, you should re-examine your beliefs. Now, I'm more dubious that, in fact, personally, that what I've said really, really corresponds to what you're talking about, because it was written down by people who didn't even know the Earth orbited the Sun. And I therefore, you know, having looked at the doctrines of the major religions, I see no evidence that science is compatible with them. But if you do, that's great. But the bottom line is, if your beliefs system is firm, but it disagrees with the evidence of reality, you have to re-examine your beliefs. So you should, in fact, do what you're doing, which is to try and see how your beliefs can conform to the evidence of science. And so therefore, that's fine. And if science validates your beliefs for you, that's fine for me. Just, however, be a little skeptical and don't believe everything you read. And unfortunately, I have to tell you that this notion that water molecules change their form depending upon how you talk to them, I'm afraid, is something that I don't think most scientists would accept.
Shakira, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Lawrence, as you mentioned, Richard Dawkins did the afterword to your book, and he's also been a guest on Radio Times. And I know he doesn't like to debate creationists and people who he, frankly, really disagrees with. Is there anything to be gained from that, from your perspective? We have about a minute or so here.
Well, yes and no. I think if you can educate people about how the universe works, it's worth having a discussion. But a debate with people who believe in nonsense, all it does is elevate their beliefs and make it sound like they're sensible. I mean, if they're really well-informed hucksters, they can sound really sensible on a radio program. And so what they want to get on radio programs with me or Richard, because it gives them a platform. And in some sense, I'd rather not give them a platform to confuse people. On the other hand, if one can have an intelligent discussion and try and indicate how the universe really works, I'm all in favor of it.
And so. Were you always a good science student?
I guess so, yeah.
I mean, you must have had good teachers along the way as well.
I had some good teachers and some bad teachers. I survived the bad ones and was inspired by the good ones. And ultimately, as I say, it was my own reading, I think, that really excited me the most.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Lawrence Krauss, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure. It's been fun. Thanks.
Fun for us as well. He's a cosmologist, not a cosmetologist. He's a cosmologist, foundation professor, and director of the Origins Project. That's at Arizona State University. He's written a number of books, including a new one called A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. And that was our topic for today's Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. And engineer Kevin Griffin, Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, Debbie Builder, and Jonathan Bess produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss going, closing things out with the OJs. Was the ocean.